This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
And welcome to the Shakti Hour, a podcast on Ram Dass Be Here Now Network, where I speak with women about their personal experience on the spiritual path. My name is Melanie, and today I'm sharing a conversation with the lovely Mirabai Star. Mirabai and I had a chance to meet at the most recent Ram Dass Immersion Retreat at Hanuman Gardens in California. And so before the retreat began, we took some time to talk and discuss her most recent book, Caravan of No Despair, a memoir of loss and transformation, along with several other really beautiful topics. And I love listening to Mirabai's teaching and reading her books because of the poetry and the weaving together of so many different mystical traditions that she does in both of her writing and in her teaching and in her life. I hope very much that you will enjoy this conversation, and please do go to the Shakti Hour page at BeHereNowNetwork.com, where you'll find the Amazon link to purchase Mirabai's books. And if you purchase through that link, a portion of the proceeds do come back to the Be Here Now Network to support the Shakti Hour and all the other podcasts and offerings here. Please also remember to subscribe to the Shakti Hour on iTunes. And thanks very much for listening. So I'm here with the beautiful Mirabai Star, and I thought it might be interesting to just offer us a little bit of information about your name to start.
What a great opening question, Melanie. So Mirabai was a 16th century Indian mystic, Rajasthani princess, actually, who was born into wealth and power and privilege and voluntarily abdicated all of that, relinquished all of that to follow her beloved Lord Krishna. For her entire life, she sang and danced to her beloved. So her poetry is still very much sung and spoken and honored throughout India. And when I was 13, I lived in New Mexico, and the school that I went to in Taos was run by the Lama Foundation at that time. And so we spent a lot of time up at Lama, where Ram Dass, of course, created Be Here Now. And so let's see, this would have been 1974. So it was right after Maharaji left his body. And the atmosphere was so charged with the energy of Neem Karoli Baba. And many of the teachers at our school, or several of the teachers at our school and people who lived at Lama, were Neem Karoli Baba followers. So there was a lot of satsang gathering in that area, and they were our teachers, our drama teacher, our music teacher. And so the children, we wrote a play about the life of Mirabai that Surya and Sarada brought back, a comic book from India, you know, those comic books of the saints and gods and goddesses. And so using the comic book, we, the kids, wrote this musical play about the life of Mirabai, and I played Mirabai. And after that, I was given the name by my friends, and then that summer, Ram Dass kind of gave it the stamp of approval. So I'm 56. I was 13. That's a long time ago. But that connection with her energy, the energy of Mirabai, it so perfectly resonated with my soul then and still. That the devotional quality for sure, the artistic impulse, the expression in word and song, that's so much matches my being. But more than that, there's something about what she calls me to be. And it has a lot to do with embodiment, because I have a tendency to go out, you know, get me out of this place. It's hard here. And she brings me back again and again, which I think is the way of the feminine.
And how, I have a couple questions come to mind. Mirabai herself was a poet. So in that time in India, just thinking of women in India in that time, she was educated enough to know to write. She was educated to write, read and write. And or do you think it was it just devotional prayer from her heart? Or
yeah, I think it was. I don't think these were composed pieces. Yeah. I think they were spontaneously uttered and written down by her followers, very much like Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi, who we know as Rumi or Hafiz, or the other ecstatic Sufi poets. I think it was very much in Kabir in India, very much in that lineage of spontaneous arising of love language.
I first learned about her through the Indian singer Lata Mangeshkar. And I do, there's a sample of her at the beginning of all the Shakti Hours, but that's how I came to her poetry, was through that voice. And it's so beautiful, and I don't have to know even the meaning of it to experience the sweetness of that romance, really.
And it's sweet fire is what it is. Yeah. It's not sweet softness. I mean, there's an element of tenderness for sure, but it's fiery and electrical and wild and unleashed.
And how, you said since you were 13 to 56, how is your relationship to that name shifted over time?
Well, you know, I think that often on our spiritual paths, as we develop and mature, there is this natural kind of movement toward a non-dual consciousness. And so for a while, I experienced my bhakti devotional nature as being different from this impulse I had toward undifferentiated states of consciousness. It didn't bother me that they were different. It wasn't like a conflict. In fact, I sometimes felt like they're supposed to be conflicted, the bhakti path and the non-dual path, but they never have been for me. They've always been both very natural and in a sense integrated from the get-go. But what I guess I have found is that I'm reclaiming my devotional nature at this stage in my life, and that I don't have to deny that I'm madly in love with a God that I don't believe in necessarily with my analytical mind. I don't really have a belief system that I subscribe to. And that's okay with me. And so, but I do have this passionate love that is no less alive for me at 56 than it was at 13. I mean, it's different, but it's also not. It's this timeless kind of ecstatic and also painful longing. And for years, I thought the longing is because I was told by some of my spiritual teachers that longing is somehow an artifact of illusion, that we suffer from the illusion of separation. You're not separate. I mean, I'm small. I'm 5 feet tall and about 103 pounds. So I don't take up a lot of space in this world. And I just somehow that my physical form seems to invite a certain kind of patronizing. I don't know, it elicits that sometimes in people, especially men. And so I've often been kind of told that this longing thing, the mirabai longing, is somehow an immature expression of the spiritual life, and that the higher truth is non-dual. Like, mirabai, you're already there. You already have it. There's nothing to long for. It is you. It is in you. It is you. It's like, blah, blah, blah. I know that. But my heart is on fire.
Yeah.
And I know that's real. And the longing itself is the connection, as all of the great mystics of all spiritual traditions tell us. And they don't usually tell us that in essay form, by the way.
Right.
They tell us in poetry and in song. It's right. The language of the heart cannot be denied. You can't convince the heart that longing is somehow a problem.
You know, it. So this was 13 when you got this name, this initiated, and you're saying that this fire was in your heart from them, is still there now, and you're reclaiming it. But I was curious when I was reading your memoir about the time before that. And I wondered if you, because you had this big event with the loss of your brother, and I wondered if you sensed this about yourself before then. Mm. Did you, like, when did you begin to know this part of yourself?
Yeah. Well, so my brother Matty died when he was 10 and I was 7. And he died of cancer, of a brain tumor. And so it was, well, for my mom, it was extremely fast. It was less than a year from diagnosis to death. But my point being that, unlike my own experience of losing a child in a car accident where I had no preparation, my parents, although it was horrific, experienced the gradual letting go of their child and me of my brother. And so there was this quality of, as he got sicker and sicker, the veil kind of got thinner and thinner. Mm. And I was only a child. I was 7 years old. But I felt myself, like, in retrospect, of course, not at the time, I didn't have the reflective consciousness, but looking back, I felt that I was abiding with him in this kind of numinous space. Mm. So by the time he died, that space was very real for me and continued to be available. But I had no language for it, not only because I was a child, but because nobody could talk. Nobody was talking about that. And so each subsequent death, and I've had an incarnation so far that's been marked by an unusual number of deaths, each one gave me access to that holy, holy ground that death can invite us into. And so although I've had many tragedies, I've also had, each one has been an opportunity to make my home in this sacred space somehow. And so, yes, my spiritual life has always been intimately entwined with death. And death has been a doorway, a gateway, a passage into that space. And I also, of course, lost my... So the other part of the mirabai story is that my first love, Philip, was killed in a gun accident right before the mirabai play. And so when I played mirabai as a 13-year-old girl at Lama, I was already in that blasted open space from Philip's death. So they've always been entwined.
Yeah. We are at Hanuman Gardens in preparation for the second Ram Dass immersion retreat. And so we're sitting in this beautiful room, and it's the desert, and it's very hot. So we have all the windows open. So any sounds that you're hearing about are sounds of the outside world, but we're going to keep them in just to keep it real. But I had this experience when I was 5, my grandmother died. And I remember being at the funeral in this very conservative Lutheran farming town church, and they, someone sang, started singing a hymn, and I started wailing.
As a 5-year-old?
Yeah. I started wailing, and I was inconsolable, but I didn't, I'm relating to that, that you're not grasping death and life either. You're still in a very playful, imaginative state at that moment in your life. And so that moment of openness to connect directly with the, what did you say? Numinous. Yeah. Like that kind of space was there. And and it was very, no one was expressing any emotion.
Oh.
And I just remember being hit by the song, by the hymn, and the, and that just breaking out.
Oh, I feel like crying just listening to that. And that was, so your connection as a musician.
Yeah.
There's also a similar kind of thing that when your heart gets blasted open.
Yeah.
I mean, that music can become the portal to that sacred space. Of course, we all know about the connection with music. It's why sacred music is so essential to every spiritual tradition. But for you, it was also connected with pain.
Yeah.
And the beauty of that state.
Yes.
The intimacy.
Yes.
Mm.
And to the point of it being within any tradition. So, you know, that hymn written, I want to say it was How Great Thou Art, but so it's a devotional hymn, right? And so in a way that freed me from religion.
Yes.
In that moment to go into the spirit.
Right. Beautiful.
And so, but that's a very vulnerable place.
Yes.
To be.
And I think the feminine, you know, this is your show, the feminine, I think is so much about being vulnerable, and it's not fun necessarily. It's not comfortable. It can be a lot of fun. It's not comfortable. It's not comfortable to the ego.
And it's such there's a wiring, I feel, to the heart, to the emotional heart that is part of the beauty of the feminine capacity, but like you said, not necessarily fun, like to be present to those emotions. And so that longing that you're talking about, like, feels to me when you're sharing about it like a longing for to just be absorbed in that.
That's it.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's, you know,
it's not to go somewhere else or to be something different, but the longing for wholeness, for oneness.
Precisely. It's the longing itself becomes the energy of union. And I think that's why bhakti yoga is a yoga. I mean, yoga, of course, means path of union or path to union with the one.
Yeah.
And so, not only is it a valid path, it's probably the most potent of all of the yogas, because that the shakti of yearning sends us into the arms of the one, where our individuality then of course dissolves and we become one with the object of our heart's deepest desire. So it doesn't do any good to be told that there's something pathological about our desire for God or our feeling of separation. The pain of separation is not a problem.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, what I love about your story and your telling of it in your book is the honesty of all the relationships.
Hmm. Right. Relationships are not an obstacle.
Right. And that working through that connection on the physical plane, in the material realm with one another.
Yes.
Is your own journey. And I think that might be another feminine
yes
aspect of spirituality, that the monastic life is available, obviously, to women and men, but that the crucible of relationship is so much our playing field.
Yes, it is so feminine. It's tantric. It's Shakti. It's you're absolutely right. And do I always want to hang out here? No. In fact, I think my whole life, Melanie, since I was a girl, I've wanted a monastic life. And it's not my karma. It is not my way. And it's not only my personal karmic configuration, I think. I think it's also about being a woman and being embodied and being relational and finding the spiritual life right here in our bodies and our relationships and our communities. And that somehow for me to check out of it, even though it's tempting, it's not the work that I've been given to do or that many of us are being called to. And we really get that it's right here.
Yeah. And I'm just sensing in that too, this capacity to expand and to give and to see, you know, where is there more to give, you know, with all the losses in your story and just with life itself and the demands that come, there's something inspiring about being backed into a place where you have to continue to give.
Backed into it, yeah.
So that you're forced to source the eternal.
Beautifully said.
Yeah.
What's that like for you? I mean, how do you keep stepping up?
I was fighting the place of true giving, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I had exhausted the learned role of the woman giving.
Yeah.
Right? The kind of the surface give till you are exhausted kind of make sure everybody else is taken care of first kind of
the
thing.
Martyr, yeah.
The martyr mother thing, mm-hmm. Managing martyr mother thing. And I think I just have moved into that place of, oh, but this, the actual giving, the actual capacity to give is something very different.
Yes.
And it doesn't even have a lot to do with these day-to-day things. It's a much deeper calling of offering.
That's
is
beautiful.
This resonating?
Yeah, it is. And so I think the whole key, I think, is being true to our nature. You know, we're all actually different. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we try to squeeze ourselves into the boxes that we think are spiritual or sacred activism or any kind of activism, we have these notions, these preconceived notions of what it means to be of service. And they sometimes prevent us from actually finding what is our true task in this world and finding how to reconnect with that which resources us, as you say, that inner replenishing, that somehow we feel guilty if we find ways to, like for me, that monastic inclination I've had all my life, is there's something true about it. And so even though I'm really committed to embodiment, to sacred activism, to showing up, I also know that I have a deep thirst for the quiet. And so I make sure, well, I can't even help it anymore. My soul demands that there is quiet built into my life. So when I'm home between, I travel and teach a lot. When I'm home, I don't have the radio on. I'm not even playing, and I love music. I often don't even have music on because I have this deep need for simplicity, silence, and solitude. And that's where I go when I need to refill, which is quite often. And that's okay with me. I get it now that's what my soul requires in order to step up.
Yeah, I mean, in your story, it doesn't, not to trivialize it at all, but it felt like an action movie or a video game of just like if you were having to conquer all these different things just one after the other. it just felt like you were running a marathon.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, you're talking about now having this solitude, having quiet, and having these moments of recharge to go back out. How has that evolved for you? I mean, what were you sourcing through all of this trauma of your life until this place? How has that evolved for you in taking care of yourself and showing up?
Poetry, music, art. The arts have always been the wellspring that has fed me. So yeah, we've talked alluded a few times to my memoir. So it's called, and you probably have already introduced it, but just to reiterate, it's Caravan of No Despair, a memoir of loss and transformation. And so you're right, it's a loss after loss, not just deaths, although there are plenty of those, but loss of innocence, loss of virginity, loss of community. There are many losses in this book that are catalysts for a deeper and deeper surrender. And the reason it's called Caravan of No Despair is not because it's a litany of all the shitty things that have ever happened to me so that people will, you know, feel sorry for me or think I'm special. It's my affirming my participation in the human condition that we all share. And the title, Caravan of No Despair, comes from that famous Rumi couplet, "Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Even if you have broken your vows 1,000 times, come, come again, come." This is actually inscribed on Rumi's tomb in Konya, in Turkey. It's, we all belong, we all belong. And we've all broken our vows 1,000 times. Hmm. And yet, ours is not a caravan of despair. We are in this together, we are on this journey together, and it's a journey that is infused with poetry, with beauty, with yearning, and also with belonging.
That's lovely. But I, you know, still am struck by your individual strength in the midst of this story. And not everyone in the story, not all the characters, rise to the occasion.
Right. Yeah.
So it's interesting to me how held in that light your story seems to be through all the twists and turns and ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if it felt that way to you, like if there was a knowing in you that you were held through all of that.
Mm.
Or when did that become a knowing for you, or has it?
Mm. Well, you know, I've had a lot of good teachers and been exposed to a lot of teachings. As I mentioned, I was 14 when I got the name Mirabai, but I was 13 when I really started on this spiritual path by virtue of just being plunged into it at Lama Foundation. But I was exposed to a lot of great dharma, and I had that to rest in, even though I didn't know it consciously. Even as recently as the death of my daughter Jenny 15 years ago, when I'd been on a spiritual path for quite a long time, I was 40 at that point, I didn't consciously recognize that I was drawing on all of the teachings, but of course I was resting in them because they were there and they were available to me. But Melanie, the main one, was not knowingness, the holiness of not knowing, of the mystery. And I knew just enough to know that I knew nothing and that my only task was to let myself down into the arms of the mystery. And I think that has been my single greatest source of healing and transformation.
And that's just so brave to me. I mean, that just feels that you were born with this bravery to allow yourself down on that, what's it called? Not a bungee, but the
yeah,
the belay, I want to say.
Right. Yeah, when you rappel on yes, a belay line or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And it strikes me, you know, in more and more of these conversations that I'm blessed to get to have with beautiful women, it really is like the stories, like the myths, like these mythical goddess creatures and figures, characters that we get to be named after, that we each do come with this gift of our own, this strength of our own teaching to run through the play of life with that and encounter, you know, because I could for me to live your life, if this character were put in that situation, my response would likely be very different
and not lesser, not a problem.
Right, not a problem, but a different story.
Yeah.
And so living this present to each of our stories and sharing them is so valuable for everyone.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, as a grief counselor, I've never sat with a bereaved person who I didn't experience as being incredibly brave and beautiful and willing to show up for the transformational experience. Because it's like, where else are you going to go? And I know many of you listening right now have experienced great losses, and you know this holy space. And it's like, we're not supposed to talk about it because it's supposed to be only sad. And yet it's the holiest, and also it is the most sacred space we've ever known.
Yeah, I just think it's wonderful that you include transformation in the title with loss. And I would love for you to just share a tiny bit about what that word means to you and what that process is like to you. Because people talk about transformation and it's different than just change.
Right.
So what would you say is a transformation?
And it doesn't necessarily require volition. In fact, often our will is an obstacle to transformation.
Yeah, say more about that.
I mean, there's a willingness involved. I'm a translator of the Christian mystics. So I'm a Jew from New York, or at least that's, you know, my parents are, and I was born in New York, and they were refugees from that world. But I grew up in a secular Jewish family that was drawn to Hinduism, Buddhism, to the Dharma traditions. And I, at a very young age, became deeply connected to Sufism, various Sufi orders, but knew nothing about Christianity until really my 20s when I encountered the Christian mystics and just fell in love with them. And one of the things I love about Santa Teresa de Avila, St. Teresa of Avila, who I translate from the 16th century Spanish. She was a contemporary of Mirabai, by the way. I love that.
Oh, really?
Huh. My two girls. Huh. what a coinky dink. So one of the things I love about Teresa of Avila and all the Christian mystics is they speak about this kind of co-creative relationship between God and the soul, where we show up for the work of spiritual practice, but we're surrendering at the same time to grace. So it's this beautiful dance between willingness to be transformed, doing the work of purification in a sense, and yet knowing that we're not in charge and that grace is grace. It comes or it doesn't, and transformation happens or it doesn't. So there's a willingness to be transformed, but there's also an intention to meet the beloved halfway and do the work. And so I think that's what transformation is about. It's that combination of being present and allowing and not being in charge, knowing we're not in charge.
Yeah, that really is a loving interpretation of transformation. And it's like that patience, you know, love is patient and kind, and it's so surrendered the way that you're putting it. because I think transformation has become a buzzword, like a desired result.
Right.
Something that, you know, what if I just have loss and no transformation? What if I don't, you know, suddenly become something else, you know, or take this and turn it into something else? And I love that devoted witness to the process and allow that co-creation to happen as it need be, you know?
Mm. Well,
because I personally can say felt like I was in a chrysalis for longer than I wanted to be, you know?
Yeah.
And any attempt, as you said, any willful attempt to get out of that was just caused more pain.
Yeah.
And yeah. And each of us has that our own timing.
And it's often subtle. I think we expect these dramatic enlightenment experiences. Right. And lo and behold, I am just as neurotic as I used to be. But I'm perhaps a little more aware of it, one, and definitely have more tenderness toward myself, too. When I act out in all those ways that I thought I'd be long over with and above, you know, thought I'd be. I had these visions, these versions of what an enlightened being is, like Ananda Mayama was my main one. I remember saying to Ram Dass recently on the phone, you know, when you met me and I was 14 years old, my model of enlightenment was Ananda Mayama, and I was pretty sure by 16 that would have happened. And here I am at 56, you know, just as neurotic as ever. And he said, but you are Ananda Mayama. You know, the reason you resonated with her is because that is exactly, you know, who your being is too, but it just looks way different than your little, you know, ego expectations of what enlightenment looks like. In other words, I'm not an enlightened being by any sense, by my own version of reality or anyone else's external objective version. And yet my soul is who she is. And she is awake and connected, even though my external personality part, which is just as real and just as beautiful, not to be discounted, it still suffers and struggles and misbehaves.
Yeah.
And that's holy too.
Yeah. And this is all coming back to this, the longing and the duality idea that all these things are happening together, and that holding of the relationship, the space for all these things to have a relationship within your own being.
So the beauty of contemplative practice, as well as devotional practice, but contemplative practice, that is silent sitting or silent walking or whatever it may be, but those practices that bring us into the present moment, is that this enormous, this vast spaciousness opens up whenever we set the intention to just be present, as fully present as we can be in the moment with what is, with exactly what is. Mm. And then there's enough room for all of it.
Can you describe a bit about your experience of what that's like to sit in stillness and in presence and have everything be as it is?
Would you like me to read a paragraph from my book?
Sure.
About that?
Sure.
With reticence at first, and then with mounting courage, I dared to mourn my child. From the very beginning, I suspected that something holy was happening, and that if I were to push it away, I would regret it for the rest of my life. There was this sense of urgency, as if turning from death meant turning from my child. I wanted to offer Jenny the gift of my commitment to accompany her on her journey away from me, even if to do so simply meant dedicating my heartbeat and my breath to her and paying attention. And so I showed up. When a feeling I did not think I could survive would threaten to engulf me, I practiced turning toward it with the arms of my soul outstretched. And then my heart would unclench a little and make space for the pain. years of contemplative practice had taught me just enough to know better than to believe everything I think. How to shift from regretting the past and fearing the future to abiding with what is. In this case, a totally fucked up thing. The ultimate fucked up thing. I sat with that. I did not engage in this practice to prove something to myself or anyone else. I was not interested in flexing my spiritual muscles. I did it for Jenny. My willingness to stay present through this process was an act of devotion. By leaning into the horror and yielding to the sorrow, by standing in the fire of emptiness and saying yes to the mystery, I was honoring my daughter and expressing my ongoing love for her. It was not mere mindfulness practice. It was heartfulness practice.
Yeah. That speaks exactly to my question. And also to devotion, to the devotional path, and that the love and the longing for your lost daughter was held in that practice as well.
Right. And that's why I keep saying it's not.
Yeah.
Like death, grief. Grief is not a problem to be solved. It sucks. I hate it.
Yeah.
And I hate that those of you listening have had to endure the losses that you carry. And also something else. Something. There is an infinite spaciousness in the heart that doesn't make it okay. Like, this is not a spiritual bypass I'm talking about here. Like, just meditate your way into this, you know, numinous realm where loss is an illusion. No, no, no. It's about fully inhabiting the human condition, which is the holiest space I know. Otherwise, we'd all be out there in the ethers with no egos and no bodies.
Right. And it can be so difficult in that space to stay present. At least in my experience, the biggest difficulty I've had in staying present during grief has been this part of me that is convinced it can change it. Right? There's this, even though there's a finality to it, for me, there was difficulty staying present because there was a desire. The desire to have it be otherwise was so strong that then the will wanted to fix it.
Exactly. And there's, you know, there's a chapter in the book called, I think, something like Navigating the Landscape of Loss, in which I take Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief and kind of reimagine them as stations on the spiritual journey. And one of the things we learn is that in the bargaining phase, which is three, and it's not a linear journey, and that's kind of what that chapter is all about, is that the illusion of some kind of beginning, middle, and end is dispelled by showing up for what is. But bargaining is that part of the grief journey where the brain, which is designed to solve problems, is trying to solve the problem of death. Right. And so we get in this monkey mind loop where we can't stop going over and over and over trying to make the outcome different than it is. And it's not an accident that the station of grief following bargaining is called depression. Unfortunately named. It's not depression. It's the dark night of the soul. It's that place of dropping down into the emptiness and surrendering. It's the place where we finally allow ourselves to feel sorrow, and there's nowhere else to go. And so bargaining ultimately spins itself out and comes to rest in the darkness, which is a kind of holding, to come back to your question earlier, like, when did you feel held in all of this? I felt most held when I was most surrendered. Like, I fucking give up. There's nothing I can do to make this different than it is. There is nowhere I can go. I surrender. And that's when I found myself held. And it wasn't like, oh, wow, there are arms holding me. It was very subtle.
Yeah.
But very real.
Yeah. And in the poetry of that, like in poetry itself or in art itself, there's that the space, that gap in between it that is that.
Right. And we're conditioned to get away from those spaces.
Yeah. 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 And in time has no relationship to time.
No. Right.
Not in the way that we understand it.
Yeah.
And when we were at retreat in May, Ram Dass said, dying and sadhana are the same thing.
Really? He said that? That's so great.
And it was, Duncan had asked a question about how do I get over my fear of death completely? So there was a lot of talking about, and Ram Dass gave a beautiful explanation of the afterlife. But then he kind of wrapped it up with that. And that's been something I've been working with.
Say it again.
Dying and sadhana are the same thing.
And every spiritual tradition I know of, Melanie, says some version of that. Of that annihilation is the path to union. And my namesake, Mirabai, you know, beautifully expresses that in her poetry. The moth being drawn to the flame. The lotus, that she ends one of her poems by saying, the single lotus will swallow you whole. That's sadhana, it's death and transformation.
Wow. Well, I have been asking everyone if they could give a piece of advice specifically to women and girls on the spiritual path.
So we still, in spite of all of the great efforts of our mothers and grandmothers, we still seem to carry around this sense that we are not enough and that we're too much, both. I mean, talk about mixed messages that we're expected to grapple with and carry. What a burden. And so I've been saying it throughout this conversation, and so I'll just reiterate that what we are, who we are, what we have, is not only not a problem, it is the God-infused sacred ground that we walk on. You are enough. You're not too much. You're exactly right, just as you are.
Great. And that is that surrendered place of being present to all that is.
Exactly.
Well, if this is any indication of the next few days, I think everybody's in for a treat.
Thank you, Mom.
Here at Hanuman Gardens. And please remember to go to the Shakti Hour page at BeHereNowNetwork.com, where you'll find the Amazon link to purchase Mirabai's books. And stay tuned. I know she's working on a new book right now, so stay tuned for that sometime next year.
A book about the way of the feminine.
Hello.
Wild Mercy. I think it's going to be called Wild Mercy.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
So thanks so much, Mirabai.
Thank you, Melanie. You're so much fun to talk to.
Thank you. Bandh bandh.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.